405 DGS and KMOX. It's always a pleasure and privilege to talk to our good friend, Senator Jim Talent. Jim, good to talk to you. How are you?
Doing well, Dave. How are you?
Doing fine, thank you. So this meeting between Putin and Kim Jong-un and the signing of what's basically like a communist NATO treaty kind of thing, it feels like the kind of thing you read in history books.
Yeah, I think it's pretty significant. I was going to say an irony, but Kim Jong-un and North Korea may have the biggest stockpile of artillery shells, the enablers for traditional ground combat in the world, because that's really how they structured their army in the event of a war with the South. And that happens to be just what Russia needs in Ukraine, because that war is a war of attrition, a sequential rather than combined warfare. And in that kind of a context, these basic enablers are really important. So Putin needs those, and Kim Jong-un is going to want. The Russians are good at missile technology, space, and nukes, in particular relative to North Korea. So we can expect that to go back in the direction of Pyongyang.
So, Jim, you'll understand the gist of this question. Is this saber-rattling, or is this real? Is this the kind of thing that if you were in the Defense Department, you would really be watching this one?
Well, I don't think in the DOD they're sitting there thinking this is going to mean North Korea is going to do something really big soon. It's an ominous development because it's going to assist Putin in Ukraine. It's going to assist the North Koreans in developing, in particular, their missile technology. But now, what in Indo-PACOM, what they worry about is China. And one interesting issue is how the Chinese view this. If this had happened a couple of years ago, I might say, you know, Beijing may not be all that pleased about it. But I think under the circumstances, they probably signed off on it.
And why would that be, Jim? What has changed in the past few years?
Well, Russia's become, it was always a junior partner, but it's become such a junior partner now. I think the Chinese know that anytime they want to revive, for example, their ambitions on Eastern Russia, they probably can do it. They put out a map a few months ago of Eastern Russia, and the cities, the name of the cities are in Chinese on their map. And that's not a mistake for them. They have about 80 or 90 people, a million people on their side of the border, and the Russians have 3 or 4. And they've claimed that territory. But the point is, I think right now they're figuring, well, this is good for us in terms of our short-term ambitions, and if we want to make any move against Russia at any time, we probably can. I also think that there's probably some genuine personal connection between Xi Jinping and Putin. It certainly seems that way.
Yeah. Speaking of Ukraine, I was recently in a group of very conservative friends of mine, about 6 of them, and Ukraine came up, and it was split down the middle between Russia is the evil empire, we have to fight them at all costs, Ukraine's doing our fighting for us, we're just writing checks, this is the best deal we're ever going to get. And then the other half of the conservative group would say, no, this is a boondoggle, this is a modern Vietnam, we're throwing good money after bad, we can deal with Russia diplomatically. What do you make of that?
Well, I think I'm mostly in the first group, but mostly because, you know, when this war broke out, I wrote a column about it, and I said, you know, Russia has deliberately, under Putin, has made itself comprehensively the adversary of the United States and our interests, and not just in Eastern Europe, but in the Middle East, where they have they are allies of Iran and have supported Bashar Assad and enable the arming of Hezbollah, and of course, we just talked about the Far East, where they, you know, Putin has declared his treaty of unlimited friendship with China. They do military exercises with China. So the point is, he's our adversary, and you know, it's a basic rule: the enemy of your adversary is your friend. Mm-hmm. So I thought and believe it was a good idea to arm the Ukrainians. Now, I also wrote a column about a year after that saying, I don't think it's in our interest to finance indefinitely a stalemated battlefield. So the issue is how to get Putin to the table. You know, I don't see that the administration has any real plan to do that. But, you know, I would be okay with a negotiated solution that allowed with Ukraine coming into NATO. And I think that's the only basis under which you could get one.
Jim, this question is more philosophic and maybe even a bit childlike, but you know, you have Russia and you have Iran and you have China and North Korea, and to us it's so clear that we're the good guys and we are a democracy and you guys are authoritarian and we're good to our people, you're bad to your people. In your experience and estimation dealing with these people, do they know that? Do they know they're the bad guys, but they want what they want? Just like someone who robs a bank, they know they're breaking the law, but they want the money. Or do you think that they feel the exact opposite? We're the bad guys.
Well, first of all, Dave, I have to say you're sometimes philosophic and sometimes childlike, but rarely both at the same time. That's a good question. I mean, nations, and I've always been more of what they call a foreign policy realist, which is in a sense that I believe there's no question, the United States has vital national interests, defense of the homeland, a right to move, trade, and travel on equal terms as other countries. I mean, there's like three or four of the scholars will give you. And I think the purpose of American foreign policy should be to protect and advance American interests. Now, where the good guy thing comes in is that the way we define our interests is not oppressive. In other words, we're not out to conquer other countries. I mean, we really just want, as I said, to defend our own homeland, to be able to move, trade, and travel on the same terms as everybody else, and to resolve disputes peacefully where possible, but in any event, without escalating armed conflict. So that's why I think it's our interests and our objectives that make us the good guy. Typically, our allies and partners are at least better in terms of how they treat their people and what their ethics are than our enemies. But that, as you know, I mean, we certainly helped the Soviet Union a lot in World War II, didn't we?
And we sure did.
You know, right. And I'm not going to defend Stalin's ethics, even in a relative sense with anybody.
Jim, before I let
do they realize it? No, by and large, no.
Yeah.
I honestly think, and particularly the Chinese. And it's very important to understand that the way we look at the world in relationship among peoples is actually quite unique in the history of the world. And that the way, for example, Xi Jinping looks at it is more typical. I mean, he thinks the international order should be a hierarchy with the big dogs at the top getting the benefits.
Yeah, I was going to say, follow up immature question, but what do they think that we get wrong? You know, what is it when they look at the West other than, like, I know Iran thinks that we're heathens and, you know, we're basically heathens and we don't follow Sharia law. But the communists, what do they look at and think that makes us weak or wrong?
Well, I think they kind of, at the end of the day, they're making decisions based on how they define their interests as we do. And mm-hmm. what they see and understand is that our objectives, particularly in their part, I'm talking about China now, let's just mm-hmm. focus on them. So they want to dominate their strategic environment. They have declared sovereignty over the waters of the East and South China Sea and they want to be able to extract the resources and they want to be able to control the terms of trade in that region. That's just their regional objectives. Well, that's obviously, those are obviously objectives that are inconsistent with anything we can tolerate, right? So they understand we're the obstacle, and in order to achieve their objectives, they have to overcome the leadership and power of the United States. And so they're aimed at doing that. It's a class. I gave a speech to a group of veterans, I don't know, year and a half ago, and I tried to analyze this in a value-neutral way, and I said it's really a classic conflict between a status quo hegemon, the United States, and a rising hegemon, China, which by the way, doesn't make it less dangerous. It makes it more dangerous.
Jim, before I let you go, I want to ask you a political, legal question regarding Louisiana and the Ten Commandments. As a lawyer and a former law professor, as a devout Christian, but a legal scholar, how does this hit you?
You've been kind enough to compliment me for my devotion to my faith. I always cringe a little bit, but that's nice of you to say. Well, I think under the existing Supreme Court rulings, assuming they're still good law, this is probably unconstitutional. But the court has not addressed this specific question, but has made other rulings, which lead real legal experts, Dave, not me, to suggest that they may uphold this. Now, I will tell you how I would interpret the Establishment Clause. Okay, I do think it creates a separation of church and state. I think having separate spheres protects both. However, I don't think the founders ever intended to make unconstitutional actions that that acknowledge the religious impulse in American society. Okay, so like a moment of silent prayer at the beginning of school. And I think this comes pretty close to that. It's more or less, it's a recognition of the importance of the Ten Commandments in American history and underpinning American culture. But a more aggressive type action, certainly trying to proselytize people. No, I think the Establishment Clause does prohibit that. So this is, I think it's, most scholars would say that it's probably in a gray area, and we'll see if the Supreme Court ever hears the case and what it decides.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you, Jim. That was very helpful, and I apologize for my immature questions, but I figure if I got them, other people got them.
You're the one who said that you were asking a childish question.
I appreciate it. Thank you, my friend.
Okay, guys. Bye-bye.
We're talking about the Hajj going on right now in Saudi Arabia. 1,000 people have died from mostly heat exposure.
Oh, I was going to say it had to be the heat, right? There wasn't, because I didn't see any incident
on the ground there.
Oh,
right?
Wow. Insane.
Amazing. 1.5 million people trying to get up there to touch that stone. Man. 1,000 have died already.
You sit in traffic now, but later, there's an ice cold reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, all your patience is paid out in gold. You remain calm through honks, bumper to bumper, and people yelling.
Come on, move!
You are a fighter, and Modelo is your reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
I always say, people want to be famous. No, you don't. Justin Timberlake, more stuff's coming out. Have you seen this? He was drowning his sorrows.
Yeah, because of the Britney Spears documentary that came out in 2021.
And then he lost $2 million on a real estate transaction and his tour's not selling. And Skippy the Punk, 21-year-old cop who pulled him over, didn't know who he was or why he'd be on tour.
That's the best.
Yeah,
I love that part.
There's the really great quote where apparently he said, "This is going to totally ruin the tour." And then the police officer said, "What tour?" And he said, "The world tour," which is...
It's pretty good.
Yeah. I'm going to be saying that every time something upsets me for a while.
The dude is worth like $250 million. What is he worried about?
That's a good point.
You know?
I love that he's trying to blame this on Britney Spears. They dated over 20 years ago, and I'm sorry there was a documentary that made you look bad for the things you did to her. And, oh, everyone's mad at him about Janet Jackson, too. Yeah, because of what you did. Like, I'm sorry that the consequences of your actions are catching up with
that
you,
led
bro.
You here.
You're lucky you had 20 years of not having to deal with it.
Right.
Yeah. We also have something interesting on the Google Doc here about the baseball writer asking an interesting question about what if we didn't have television.
Yeah, so might have been Chelsea Jane, but it's a regular baseball writer, and it's somebody I follow, and I follow basically every baseball writer you can think of. And she was just making the point that it wasn't that long ago that baseball games weren't on TV all the time. Like, it was within the last 20 years where you might get like half the games and some of them just weren't on TV. And when we were kids, it was maybe a couple games a week. You know, you had the game of the week, the national game of the week. And like in where I grew up, they had a subscription service called On TV. You had to have a special antenna on your house to get this. And that's where the games were a couple nights a week, not every night. And yet here we sit. It's almost unimaginable that any baseball game could be played without being on TV.
It is.
Isn't that crazy? Like in a very short amount of time, and I remember it wasn't that long ago. I mean, I was working here in St. Louis, so it's within the last 17 years. That we didn't have all of the games on what was then Fox Sports Midwest. Now it's Bally. And some of them were on free TV, right? You have a couple of them on Channel 5, you know, like a few a year. Mm-hmm. But there were games that just were not televised. And it's just, now it seems insane to even think that. Like, every game is on every day. No matter what day the game is, no matter where it is on television for you to watch. Obviously, the draw to the Cardinals has always been, it's always been on KMOX, even on those days.
Which is one of the things that built KMOX.
Yeah, and these two, I think, built each other, right? Because the strength of the signal and the reach of the signal helped the Cardinals build a regional fan base in a time that wildly preceded cable TV, right? They weren't nobody that was listening in Arkansas was able to watch the game. The only time you saw the game in a lot of Cardinal Nation was if you came to Busch Stadium, or they happened to be on Monday Night Baseball or the Saturday game of the week or whatever.
So take a couple minutes and talk about how we're really going into the game tonight with one boot off.
Ooh, boy, it's tough tonight. So for everybody listening, before you get mad about any moves or lack of moves, understand Nolan Arenado is not available tonight. He's not just not playing. He is not available to play tonight. Ivan Herrera is not available to play tonight. So you've got your starting lineup, and the only players on the bench are Dylan Carlson and Jose Fermin. So that's your entire bench. Everybody else is in the starting lineup, and the bottom of the lineup, boy, it goes Carpenter, Crawford, Pajes, and Ciani. So not a lot of offense there. And what I'm saying is set your expectations accordingly, because you also have Ryan Fernandez unavailable today, Leahy is unavailable, and Libertor is unavailable. So you've got five players on your roster that you cannot use. Now, the good news, they brought up Adam Klopfenstein from AAA Memphis. He's been pitching better of late. He's your length guy. So if Palante gets in trouble tonight, Klopfenstein's probably the guy that comes in and takes whatever the innings are that he can shoulder. And you do get an extra player for this game because of the travel and all of that. Hmm. So Victor Scott is on the bench.
Oh, well,
so
good.
You do have three players available on the bench as opposed to just the two.
And I hope they get him in just to get him in.
I mean, I hope so. I mean, it's probably not a pinch hitting appearance at this point.
But bad, huh?
Maybe. I mean, it's not good. I mean, he's still hitting the 100s at Memphis, so struggling to figure it out, but hopefully maybe there's a pinch running opportunity. Maybe there's a defensive opportunity, although Ciani's a pretty damn good defensive player. But you know, if you had to pinch hit for Ciani, you could always go back to Victor Scott for defense.
If you had to bet your own $10, would you bet that Walker makes it back up this year?
Yeah, for sure. I'd be shocked if he's not back up this year. It's just a matter of when. And I almost wonder if what they're just waiting for is for him to get on a tear. Like if he goes on a tear and they go, all right, now it's time to come up because you're feeling good. You know, so a lot of this, you know, Tony La Russa said it all the time. It's they're men, not machines, right? So you can look at numbers and exit velos and all those things, and they matter, but so does your mindset. And when you're in the middle of a hot streak, you're feeling good.